Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of some 40 years in this town, working on various aspects of that war, there are a few people that I've enjoyed knowing and collaborating with from time to time, and certainly admiring from afar more than our first guest. She is Victoria Tenzing. You have been seeing a lot of her lately, I suspect, at Fox News and in the press in other outlets. She is representing, at the moment, a very important individual, a man who has been an unidentified, as yet, FBI informant who has some extraordinarily important information that it sounds like we're going to be learning a lot more about. And I'm very pleased to have her with us. Victoria Tenzing, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Well, it's so good to be here. Let me lay out the basic facts for your listeners. My client is an American businessman, and in the about 2008, 2009, he was approached by Russian energy uranium companies to help in their industry in the United States. But soon thereafter, his contract started and he was working for them. They went to him and said, pay to play. You want to stay here and keep under this contract, you've got to give your money, half of your salary, to A, B, C, D, various entities, not just to one person. And he was concerned about that. And he went to the FBI and told them. And they said, look, you know, that's corruption, but we also want to know what's going on inside the Russian nuclear energy projects. So why don't you work undercover for us? And he said that he would, except he had to continue to give half of his salary. They weren't bringing in suitcases of money for him to, you know, dole out. It had to be his money. It's the pure pay to play. But the FBI told him they'd make him whole. So my client started this around 2009. And you can imagine his anguish in 2010, October of 2010, when the U.S. government approved the sale of Uranium One, a company that had 20% of the United States uranium, when they approved the sale of that company to these corrupt Russian companies. He was aghast. So he continued working undercover for several more years. In fact, there was no indictment of anybody in this involvement for 4 years after the U.S. government blessed that sale.
Victoria Tenzing, let me just pick this apart a little bit because you've given us a lot of important information here. Your client was working for the FBI and providing information that was feeding into an investigation of corruption inside not only business interests associated with this transaction, but official circles as well, as I understand it. Talk, if you would, a little bit about that in the context specifically of the process whereby this Uranium One deal was approved. It's something called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS, of which Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder were both standard members.
They both sat on that committee, and any one person could have said to the rest of the committee, listen, trust me, I can't get into it, but don't approve this. That was not done. And interestingly, because Hillary was such, she was a hawk on keeping other foreign entities out of U.S. business. This was a rare exception. Now, let me just say there might be a coincidence here, Frank. How about the fact that 4 months before this was approved, Bill Clinton went to Russia and was paid $500,000 for an hour speech, a little above my speaking fees. Plus, he was paid that $500,000 by a banking entity called Renaissance Capital, RenCap, which is personneled by former Russian intelligence people, and which had been promoting Uranium One stock.
Yeah. So that would seem to be a red flag right there. And how about the foundation, the Clinton Foundation, Victoria Tenzing?
Well, the head of Uranium One gave the foundation $2,350,000. That was just to contribute, you know, to the charity and world hunger or whatever it is the foundation does. And then other directors over the course of this time period gave tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation.
So you have this situation where there's clearly a conflict of interest on the part of Mrs. Clinton. She nonetheless votes for this transaction, which seems, as you say, to be out of character with respect to her general view of these things at the time. She allows this transfer to take place of 20% of America's uranium stocks. And so your client, I understand from your appearances on Sean Hannity's program and elsewhere, was fit to be tied over what was going on. Did he ever get an explanation of what was being done?
Yeah, the FBI agent did, he liked a lot when my client was complaining about it. Just rolled his eyes and said politics.
Well, politics seems to be much in play at the moment, of course. Your client has just been released to give testimony to the United States Congress, which finally has begun taking interest in this. Tell us about where that stands.
Let me explain the basis for that. When he started working for the FBI as an informant, they had him sign what's called an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. And there it goes on all the time, you know, in business. So in 2016, my client, who had not been reimbursed for the money he had paid out from his personal salary, and the FBI was refusing to pay it, brought a civil suit to regain the money.
Against the FBI?
No, it was against the Russians because I was not his lawyer at the time, but it was against the Russians because they, like an intimidation, it was coming back like a RICO intimidation. He threatened me and told me I had to pay to play, so give me my. When he filed this lawsuit, the Obama Justice Department, the Loretta Lynch Justice Department lawyers called the lawyer for my client at that time, the one who had filed the civil suit, and said, if the client does not withdraw the lawsuit, quote, reputation and liberty threatened. So when the Justice Department talks to me about my liberty being threatened, I think that's called prosecution. And they were implying that the non-disclosure agreement was a criminal if you violated it. And I had never, when I heard this from my client, I said, I've never heard of a criminal violation for an NDA. It's always a civil thing, liquidated damages, you know, $50,000 if you violate it.
This is extraordinary, needless to say. So just to very quickly wrap this up, where do things stand now with respect to the congressional investigations? Your client has been released to testify, apparently. What do you anticipate will be happening in the next bit?
My client will be organizing his documents over the next couple of weeks, and then we will meet. And then we will meet with probably staff for an interview with him. I mean, that's the way the process works. You don't just walk in and have the Krieg lights on you. You prepare and you find out what's important and you organize it. We will be going to Chuck Grassley's Judiciary Committee first, because he's the one that really initiated this and wrote the letter forcing the Justice Department to cough it up and release my client.
Yeah, good on him. So then this could turn into crystal ball here, I know, but this could turn into, an investigation, not just by the Congress, but by the executive branch as well.
Well, it should. And there's no way this Justice Department can investigate this case. Jeff Sessions goes out with the president and says, lock her up. I don't think it would be really good idea for him to be over an investigation of Hillary regarding this. And Rod Rosenstein was the U.S. attorney in Baltimore overseeing this case, the now deputy attorney general. And Bob Mueller, who's doing the other Russian investigation, was the FBI director at the time. So his conduct is going to be looked at. I would recommend to the Justice Department that they bring in a special counsel. And this time we might even have a crime.
Victoria Tenzig, thank you for the important representation you're providing your client right now and the work that he's about. Come back to us again with updates if you would.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're very pleased to have a chance to catch up on the streets of New York with Russ Dallin, one of our go-to guys on what's happening in Latin America, a subject with which he is intimately familiar, both by virtue of his longtime residence in the region, but also his role as the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. Russ is also the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets, and has been extraordinarily helpful to us in making sense of what is going on, particularly in one of the countries in the region that is most desperately in need of attention. He gives it to us. We're grateful. Russ, thank you for joining us to talk, among other things, about the latest out of Venezuela.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a learning pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're learning mostly from you. Let me ask you, Russ, there has been, as you know so well, nothing but bad news out of the Venezuelan economy. There is, at the moment, pending a very substantial debt payment due. What's the latest reading on whether the Venezuelan government is going to find yet another rabbit to pull out of the hat for the purposes of making that payment?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Frank. That's where all eyes in both the capital markets here in New York are all focused on, because Venezuela has a total debt stock, along with PDVSA, its state-owned oil company, of $70 billion. Outstanding dollar bond debt. They have more than that in other debt, but in terms of dollar bond debt that has to be paid on a semi-annual coupon basis in dollars, that is what we're talking about. $3.6 billion of that must be paid or comes due because of interest payments and some maturities this month and next month. So October-November liabilities for Venezuela, they had to pay $3.6 billion. So far, they have paid only $41 million of that money. They're behind on $600 million over 18 days, behind and not paying so far. And today they have a make-or-break date. The 18 days falls within a 30-day grace period. I hate to use the word grace when I talk about the narco-trafficking regime, communist regime of Venezuela, but in legal terms, so that's what it is. They have 30 days to make those payments good if they don't make it on the due date. But there is a payment of $984 million today due that there is no grace period. It must be done today.
I understand that Reuters is reporting that they expect that there will be a payment made today. Where is the money coming from? Given what's happening to PDVSA, which is the principal revenue generator for the government of Venezuela, Russ Dallin, it seems to strain credulity that they'll be able to come up with that money.
Well, they haven't been paying anything else. They haven't been providing dollars to the market. They're not even buying food for their people. Basically, if they collect for 3 months the amount of oil sales that they get of a million barrels a day, predominantly going to the United States, gives them $45 million a day. That's $1.35 billion a month. And they've been doing it since the start of September, October, and November. So you're almost talking $4 billion there that they can raise by not paying anything else, which they're doing means starving their population to make sure that they pay these payments. And it is a make or break.
Does that mean salaries for PDVSA employees and all the rest as well, or are they managing to eke out some sort of payments?
Yeah, here's the trick. They pay those salaries in monopoly money, so they don't pay them dollars. And there's no fixed rate of the bolivar to the dollar. Well, the government says there's a fixed rate of 10 bolivars to the dollar, but the black market, because they just keep running the printing presses, says the rate is now 42,000 bolivars to the dollar. So in other words, if you can get the government to give you a dollar for 10 Bs, you can turn around and sell that for 42,000 Bs, make a 4,200% profit.
So Russ Allen, what this again portends, if not today, literally, or in the next month, is just a further inexorable slide into bankruptcy. And what happens as a practical matter should the government of Venezuela essentially go, at least economically, belly up?
Well, it's a great question. And actually, yesterday I was in Washington addressing a Council of the Americas event, and actually there was a call from some of the participants to break when I told them that Venezuela made a fault today, then was tomorrow, and that $70 billion worth of debt stock may be in their mutual funds, because a lot of mutual fund managers buy a little piece of it to spice up the yield a little bit.
People wanted to go check on their holdings.
Call their brokers. Yes, people wanted to go and call their brokers. But aside from it being widespread in people's 401k mutual funds that they may not even have a reckoning of, it's mainly held by hedge funds who are willing to take those kind of risks now. It has filtered down. There are a lot of mom and pops that have held it. And indeed, when Argentina went belly up a decade and a half ago and defaulted on its debt, you know, there were dentists in Peoria and dry cleaners in Italy who, you know, were all hit because they had invested in those things.
As I recall, Paul Singer didn't take it well, though.
And Paul Singer helped develop some of the law that will be used against Venezuela in terms of forcing them to honor some of those bonds, because they don't have what we call a collective action clause, so that they will have to pay off those bonds 100% on the dollar, some of that debt, even if they do default.
Hey, Russ, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about one other issue, and that is the sort of aftermath of this fraudulent election that had happened shortly before our last talk. Governors across the country were elected, almost all of them. It seems the beneficiaries of you know, voter fraud and other hijinks. There were five who were selected or elected or allowed to be elected, or the government couldn't steal the election from, who were, I guess, associated with the opposition. Give us the latest on their fate.
So it's a great question, and let me just be clear. Actually, there was a sixth governor who should have won. And we actually found the evidence of the fraud. They weren't able to cheat enough in the election that they needed an extra 2,000 votes to help their guy win by 1,480 votes. So they actually changed the totals because you get a tally at the end of the day printed out from the computer in each voting center. But the CNE numbers that they reported differ by 2,300 votes, and the guy only won by 1,400 votes. So it was quite clear that they were fraudulent there. And the other elections, they actually had 1.6 million people voted without their fingerprints. So as we used to say here in the States, vote early, vote often. And that's essentially what happened, because that more than made up for the difference. When a government that has 20% support wins 80% of the elections, you know there's been fraud. On these governors, four of them decided, the Action Democratica, one of the two old parties of Venezuela, decided to be sworn in before this fraudulent constituent assembly, which the U.S. and almost every other country, aside from Russia and China, have agreed is a fraudulent body. The other governor, who was a member of First Justice Party, he did not. His state legislator, which is controlled by the government, Chavistas, declared him absent, and he was removed as governor-elect, was never able to sign in, and they're having a new election. So Even if you win an election in Venezuela, they don't let you win.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the case that you will actually govern. What a tragedy. Russ Dahlin, I keep hoping that one of these conversations with you about Venezuela, given its strategic importance in the region and its immense oil wealth and the privation that the people there are experiencing, that there'll be some good news, but it seems as though there's very little of that to be reported. We appreciate you nonetheless coming aboard to share with us your insights, and we'll look forward to talking with you again. Next up, we'll be speaking with Congressman Brian Babin of Texas right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure to say we are joined by a distinguished member of the House of Representatives, Brian Babin. Congressman Babin represents the people of the 36th District of Texas with great distinction, serving on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, on whose subcommittee on space he serves as its chairman. He is a man who has served his country in a number of capacities, including as an airborne artilleryman in the Army's National Guard and the Army Reserve. He is a dentist by training, a man of truly many, many parts, and a good friend of this program. We're always delighted to have him with us. Congressman Babin, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Yes, sir. Great to be with you, Frank. Looking forward to talking to you.
Well, good. I wanted to ask you about a subject. You, of course, didn't hear Victoria Tenzig on our program, but I know you've been listening to her, I'm sure, elsewhere on Sean Hannity's and other outlets. Victoria, of course, represents this as yet unidentified FBI informant who has been shedding very troubling light on this so-called Uranium One transaction. He's now been freed from a gag, in effect, on non-disclosure agreement by the Justice Department and will be headed up your way on Capitol Hill. I wonder what your thoughts are, sir, on this saga as it's been developing, and in particular, whether there is now reason to believe there really has been collusion with the Russians, only it was with Hillary Clinton and Democrats, not President Trump and his campaign.
Well, I'm looking very much forward to hearing what this this witness, who is now ungagged, has to say. I, for one, have been, in fact, I've been one of many voices that have pointed out that the Russia, so-called Russian collusion that the Democrats have been talking about for so long and so loudly really has been on the other side with the Democrats, with Mrs. Clinton's campaign. And I think this stuff is coming to light, and it doesn't surprise me one bit. I think the American people deserve the truth and are desirous of hearing exactly what's been going on. And I'm looking forward to it.
Well, and what's been going on, of course, is not limited to just this piece of it. As you know, Congressman Babin, we also have this so-called dodgy dossier. That's becoming a more murky situation by the hour. There's also, and this sort of touches on some of your work, sir, in the science, space, and technology business, the transactions that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, facilitated with the Russians that essentially amounted, according to the United States Army, your service, an overt technology theft operation known as Skolkovo. This is done under the rubric, as you know, of creating a Silicon Valley in Russia. I mean, from the point of view of whether it's uranium or this technology or other misconduct, it really seems as though there's a national security angle to all of this, as well as other crimes and misdemeanors, perhaps.
Well, it certainly looks like that. And in exchange for massive payments to the Clinton Foundation, political favors, it just can't seem to get any worse. And I am very, very concerned about this, because I can remember back in the 90s when we had some guidance systems that were that were traded to the Chinese.
Yeah, missile guidance by the Bill Clinton administration.
That's exactly right. And this was the Clintons again. These Clintons seem to have a cloud of corruption around them, which has been going on for 20 plus years.
Yeah. Congressman, I do want to switch gears with you to hit two other topics before we have to let you go. You have been very active in the House of Representatives on this whole issue of illegal immigration and refugees and problems associated with how the Obama administration particularly acted in that domain. I'm interested in your thoughts about President Trump's latest decisions to apparently begin more refugee resettlement and you know, whether there is going to be proper vetting of such people as they come in.
That's a great question, Frank. I had offered several bills, you know, over the last several years to try to curtail some of this refugee influx because of the threat of ISIS and other terrorist groups infiltrating and exploiting our very generous liberal refugee program, you know, that really the UN basically runs. And I was very happy to see him come up with the executive orders to limit from these certain, you know, terrorist countries, refugees coming in. But now, I am very leery and wary of what may be going on. We may wind up getting more refugees coming in rather than fewer. And so I'm very concerned. I can't intelligently talk about exactly what's going on with the administration's wishes right now because I just don't know. But you hear one thing, then you hear another. So this is something that we are looking into to find out exactly what the result will be of these executive orders. And, of course, some of them have been held up in court. I think the courts have basically ruled more in favor of the president now than of the left who's trying to stop this.
Well, at least the Supreme Court, which is the one that really counts, obviously. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Thank goodness for Neil Gorsuch.
Amen to that. And of course, as you say, I know as you conduct these inquiries, Congressman Babin, you'll be looking carefully at the vetting idea. And I'm very hopeful that one of the ways in which that vetting will be done, in fact, we did an amicus brief for the Supreme Court describing the importance of using an ideological filter, specifically Sharia supremacism and attachments to it, to try to make sure we're not importing more jihadists. Congressman, let me turn to one last thing. As I mentioned, you're the chairman of the Space Subcommittee of the Science and Technology Committee in the House of Representatives. You, of course, represent a good block of our space infrastructure down there in Houston. And I wanted to ask your thoughts on something I was exposed to at some length yesterday. I participated in an asymmetric warfare symposium that the group CACI and others of us sponsored. It was a terrific program, but the issue kept coming up, including in the words of a number of senior military officials, that space and especially the important use we make of it for both military and commercial purposes is very much now in jeopardy from hostile powers like China. Could you just give us a quick take on how you see that situation?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, military strategy for literally millennia, who controls the high ground normally controls the ground. And, of course, now the high ground is space. The United States has been number one for decades, but we have some adversaries that are out there with very strong space programs and intentions of militarizing space if they can. Number one comes to mind is China, and then certainly our partners for many years, the Russians. And then there are other actors out there as well that have space programs. And so I think it's imperative that the United States maintain its number one position in space, that we invest proper amounts of funding, of federal funding, to make sure that we continue our research and development because our space program, unlike China's and Russia's, we have a civilian program. Theirs are militarized. But let me tell you, even with the American civilian program, the advancements in our space program absolutely help the warfighter across the hall on the dark side or the military side. So what we develop there will certainly help our military. And we must maintain that number one position so that we can control that high ground. It's absolutely imperative that we do so.
Congressman Brian Babin, we'll look forward to visiting with you further on all of this. Thank you, sir, for the work you're doing these days, as well as your long service to our country in uniform as well. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll talk about all of this with Bill Gertz. Great to have you.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Time for our weekly visit inside the ring with our favorite tour guide, Bill Gertz, the author of a prize-winning column of that name at the Washington Times, also the senior editor of an indispensable online resource, the Washington Free Beacon. He's the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, Bill, much of the reporting that you do, and it's always incredibly important and insightful, turns on China. And I did want to start by asking for your take on what went down there over the past week or so with this party congress and Xi Jinping's 3.5-hour oration there, and the upshot of the installation of a new 7-man leadership team.
Yes, yeah, it was the exercise in bladder control for the party cadres. Definitely, we've seen this was a major event for the leadership in China, and it saw the further consolidation of power by Xi Jinping, who has emerged as the most powerful leader since Mao Zedong, who was the founder of the communist state back in 1949 and has been credited as one of the world's largest mass murderers, with a death toll of some 60 million people under his rule. What we've seen in Xi is that he has further strengthened his control over the regime there in two ways. One is he's codified in the Constitution his particular thought. This is the only leader other than Mao and Mao's successor, Deng Xiaoping, to have a name attached to their ideology or their communist ideology. The two others, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, have a certain effect on there, but their names are not attached to it. So this shows that Xi has really elevated his game. Secondly, he's really purged the Standing Committee of the Politburo. That is the 7-member collective dictatorship that rules China. And he's replaced a few people, and most notably his key deputy, Wang Qishen, who was in charge of the anti-corruption campaign and who himself was accused of corruption, and he's replaced them with less powerful people. One China expert in government compared it to the earlier Ming and Qing dynasties, where the emperor would surround himself with eunuchs to run things throughout the empire.
Fascinating, Bill. Let me ask you about what has been going on here with respect to a prominent dissident, shall we say, a former Chinese businessman, Guo Wenghui. I know that you have spent some time talking with him, and I'm interested in your take on his current status in this country. It seems as though, according to some of your reporting, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, had to really throw himself in a body block to prevent this guy from being deported by the State Department. What's going on with that?
Yeah, Guo Wangui is a really, I think, a revolutionary figure on the Chinese political scene. And he's significant for a number of reasons, but most importantly, he's described himself as a whistleblower. I call him a dissident, but he has been, since earlier this year, exposing high-level corruption. As I mentioned, he's taking credit for ousting this top leader on the Standing Committee of the Politburo, Wang Qishan, who, according to Guo, has some $2 billion in real estate investments secretly in California, which is a big no-no if you're the anti-corruption czar in China. So he's quietly been removed from all positions. I wouldn't be surprised if Wang Qishan comes under some investigation later on. That's the nature of their system. You don't just get removed from power. You get investigated and you put in prison or worse. But Guo is an important figure. There's a big push by pro-China officials within the Trump administration to send him back. And, of course, the more conservatives and pro-freedom people in the government are saying, no way, this is an important source of information. We have the president getting ready to go to China in a week or so, and he can provide valuable insights into the leadership thinking. And this is a person, because he was running in such high-level circles, including friendships with Xi Jinping himself, the top military leaders, I see him as a gold mine of information for the United States.
Yeah. Insanity, not to say, you know, inhumane, but very strategically ill-advised to be shipping him out, unless, you know, like Hillary Clinton, you want to make sure he's not around to help inform people about wrongdoing in our own country. That's
well,
a possibility.
I would mention that there is precedent during the Obama administration. A very important defector from southern China walked into the U.S. consulate in Chengdu and defected, and the Obama administration turned him back. This was, again, a lost intelligence opportunity, but it shows kind of the craven appeasement of the Obama administration.
Well, and perhaps of Obama administration holdovers in the present administration. Hey, Bill, you've also called attention to something that I think is very worrying on a lot of different fronts. It's happening to Americans, but it's also apparently happening to Guo Wangui. That is, these IT giants like Google and Twitter and so on, Facebook, YouTube, are apparently submitting to Chinese pressure and denying service to this dissident businessman. Tell us what's going on there.
It's a shameful display of these tech giants, which are seeking access to the vaunted Chinese market, and they have blocked Guo, who has really become an internet and social media sensation, especially in China, with his frequent YouTube videos and his Twitter accounts. Both, first of all, Facebook began under pressure from China, limited his Facebook pages in Chinese. Then YouTube, which was his main outlet, restricted his ability to live stream, which is, again, one of his key ways of communicating with his many hundreds of thousands of supporters. And then just recently, Twitter blocked him. All of this coinciding with the recent party Congress. And it's at least Representative Chris Smith, who runs is co-chairman of the Congressional Executive China Commission, spoke out and said that these tech giants were basically running interference for the communist regime in China.
Hey, Bill, there was one other story that I wanted to make sure we picked up on. You've reported about how the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI are warning American companies about growing threats of cyber attacks on our infrastructure. What can you share with us about all of that?
Yeah, this was a very rare and unusual alert that was sent out last weekend by both the DHS and the FBI. And it was warning that there is an ongoing cyber attack by what they described as an advanced persistent threat, which is usually code for a nation state cyber attack. Security analysts say that it's likely Russia behind it. And it's a major campaign involving efforts by the Russians to get into the networks that control our critical infrastructure. And of course, the most critical of those infrastructures is the electrical grid. It's a further indication that the Russians, along with the Chinese and others, are trying to get into our critical infrastructure in preparation for a future attack that could wreak havoc on the United States if those networks were taken down.
Yeah, literally nation-ending threat. Yeah. Bill, we have to leave it at that for today. So much more to talk about. We look forward to doing so with you next week. Come back to us. And I hope the rest of you will do the same next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.